Here I am in the 21st century. I have to say, I ain't as cool as I hoped it would be. No man on the moon, nobody on Mars. Where the hell is my flying car? Ain't nothing even like a teletransporter so far.
Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, waging the Truth Jihad by way of the internet airwaves. Every week I bring on four, sometimes five great guests telling it like it is. And there's nobody better at telling it like it is than my guest today, Ken O'Keefe. Ken O'Keefe is legendary not only for his bravery aboard the Mavi Marmara and his amazing debate on BBC's Hardfire after that, but he's developed a reputation as about the most fire-breathing, eloquent challenger of the conventional wisdom that we've got. And that's one of the reasons I really wanted to feature him in this new book, Another French False Flag. And indeed, we do have a wonderful, typically incendiary polemic from Ken in that book. So, hey, it's an honor to welcome you back. Ken O'Keefe, how are you?
Well, that's a lovely introduction, brother. Thank you very much. I'm doing very, very well, and it's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back. You know, I have a hard time keeping up with your activities. You know, you've got a lot of irons in the fire, keeping really, really busy, but popping up periodically on places like Press TV, which is where I often see you. You know, your piece in this new book, Another French False Flag, falls into the biggest section in the book, which is about the question of what is ISIS? And I thought you kind of summarized it really well. So it's a great lead off to this section on, you know, why are we all being terrorized about this ISIS group? It's, as we record this interview, we've had new supposedly ISIS-related attacks in Indonesia, in Turkey, in Cameroon. You can't keep up with them. So, Ken, what's going on with ISIS?
Well, it's amazing, actually, that we even have to ask the question, isn't it? Because these truths have been self-evident for a long time. The only thing that's really changing is that more and more people are beginning to receive the truth. They've been in a state of cognitive dissonance where it's impossible to penetrate this worldview, which is very much programmed through indoctrination. So people have been carrying on in a bit of a stupor, but more and more are becoming aware and capable of actually processing information for themselves. So you ask the question, and I'll answer the question. Well, it's another example of yet again us as the Dr. Frankenstein character creating a Frankenstein in order to justify a never-ending policy of war. We always have to have some boogeyman or something to be fighting against in order to justify this military-industrial complex and a world which essentially is run by those who know very well that the only way this tyrannical system can continue is if they maintain a very important imperative, which is to divide. And the best way to divide people, of course, is through war. Nothing divides people more. And so ISIS is just the latest manifestation of this agenda, because, of course, we have to have a reason to justify the war. So, yeah, all these attacks, you know, what's most important to know about it, as I know you know very well, is that we create this. You know, we're the ones, either directly or indirectly, in the case of ISIS, much like Al-Qaeda, the funding, most of it, came either through black ops stuff, which we would never be able to trace, or, you know, things we can trace, which is the funding from Saudi Arabia, our best friend and ally, and, you know, a nation which benefited to the tune of a $60 billion weapons deal as the most recent one. I mean, these are our best friends and allies in the region of the Middle East that are funding this stuff. And it makes a lot of sense if you're at the top of a pyramid and want to maintain a perpetual cycle of war. These policies make perfect sense. And, you know, so ISIS is the latest manifestation of that.
Well put. What do you think about the issue of to what extent this Frankenstein's monster, as you put it, has gotten out of control of its masters? You know, in the Frankenstein novel, we wouldn't have had this whole storyline with, you know, Mary Shelley wouldn't have had her novel without Victor Frankenstein going ahead and creating that monster, which turned out to be a really bad idea. But very, very quickly, the monster pretty much got outside of his control and was wreaking havoc, and he had to dedicate the rest of his life to the noble quest to put an end to his own creation. Although in the novel, of course, there's a certain sympathy for the monster as well. He didn't ask to be created. Well, with Isis, the question remains, to what extent are they really doing anything independent at all? I mean, with the Paris attacks, San Bernardino attacks, we have white paramilitaries carrying out the attacks, according to multiple witnesses. And I wouldn't be surprised if something like that turns out to be the case in the attacks in Turkey and Cameroon and Indonesia and everywhere else, too. So do you think ISIS really is spinning out of control, or is it still really just another part of the Western paramilitary apparatus?
Yeah. For sure, it's really essential for people to realize that if you are a tyrant who's enjoyed this incredible domination of the world for so long, you know very well that people in that kind of position, or individuals in that kind of position, understand some very basic prerequisites for maintaining that position of power, and there is no question whatsoever, and I'm sure you'll confer with this, the amount of awareness that has grown in recent history is such that we don't have any example of this in human history, not anything that we're aware of anyway. Even the Renaissance or anything can't even come close, because we're looking at a global awareness that is growing. This is very unsustainable for the powers that be. They need a third world war badly. In fact, it's the best option for them. And you look at the policies, picking a fight with Russia is a perfect example. Are you insane? Why would you pick a fight with Russia, especially when we look at the actions of Russia? They're very, very, very diplomatic and very reserved, quite frankly. The Turkey provocation, shooting down one of their jets, being an excellent recent example. How would America have reacted if one of our jets were shot down anywhere, quite frankly? We all know the answer to that. So what's important for people to realize, is ISIS out of control? Has the Dr. Frankenstein lost control of his creation? No, absolutely not, because one of the most important aspects of ISIS is chaos. Pepe Escobar, somebody we both know, wrote a book, called The Empire of Chaos. I haven't even read the book, but I understand the premise. The premise is that chaos is good because chaos divides people, and the only way you can maintain the system of power is by dividing the people. And so even if ISIS at certain levels is not following direct orders and are doing some things that are not approved by the empire, they still essentially are feeding the agenda of chaos and division. So in that sense, there is really no way that ISIS can be problematic for the powers that be, because chaos is pretty much their best option at this point. Nothing is going to stop this raising of human consciousness, and that is the end of them. So the best option is to divide us in every way possible, and ISIS continues to fulfill that role.
Good point. And they do it by attacking civilians. This is not something that really strikes me as anything that genuine radical anti-imperialist Muslims would ever want to do, targeting, people drinking coffee at their cafes in Paris or going to a rock concert, even if it is a satanic rock concert. San Bernardino, just a facility for the handicapped. And apparently they were attacking mosques in Cameroon. Muslims are not supposed to attack anybody's mosque. And then over in Indonesia, they're just randomly killing people there as well. In Turkey, I guess they did target tourists near the Blue Mosque. So there, at least they went after Western civilians. But you're not, number one, in Islam, you do not attack civilians. There's a very strict code and rules of war. And, jihad just means just war theory in Islam. You just don't do that. You don't commit suicide. So these people are really acting wildly in an un-Islamic way. It's also wildly counter-strategic from the perspective of, let's say, I'm a guerrilla commander trying to, help the Islamic resistance triumph over its enemies. The last thing I would do is send anybody to do stuff like this. I would be targeting the people that a lot of folks in the West would agree are bad guys. I mean, that's morally defensible to target people with blood on their hands. And it's also going to be effective from a propaganda standpoint. So for all of these reasons, it strikes me as fairly obvious that what we have here is another Operation Gladio, where we heard from Vincenzi Vinciguerra, testifying under oath in court, that you had to attack the innocent civilians in order to spread fear and justify authoritarian rule. So correct me if I'm wrong here.
No, it's really consistent with the overall policy. And, you know, one of the many elephants in the room, there's not even just one elephant in the room. We've got a bunch of elephants in our room. And one of them is, how many times has ISIS attacked Israel or Al-Qaeda, for that matter? That's a pretty revealing fact. And I'm not a Nostradamus, but I. An attack on Israel has to come at some point. I mean, it's becoming hugely problematic that not once has Al-Qaeda or Al-Nusra Front or ISIS attacked Israel. In fact, Al-Nusra Front, we know, has been receiving medical support by Israel directly in the Golan Heights and Israel itself. The fact that this entity, which is supposedly fighting this Islamic jihadist agenda, has not even once thought, much less carried out, an attack on Israel, and yet kills Muslims and Christians and every other innocent person they can find without any reservation whatsoever, tells you everything about who they're working for. I mean, the fact that they've never attacked Israel, doesn't that tell you a lot about who they're working for? And isn't it quite coincidental, by the way, that ISIS literally can easily be an acronym for Israeli Secret Intelligence Services? In fact, they serve Israeli Secret Intelligence Services very well, especially when you look at the motto of Mossad, which I know you know very well, by way of deception, thou shalt do war. Well, isn't ISIS doing a great job along those lines? I mean, it becomes extremely transparent and almost comical if it weren't so tragic. But, you know, they're not out of control. I mean, even if they don't follow the orders directly, they're still serving the agenda of the powers that be perfectly.
So don't tell me, Ken, that you're doubting the good intentions of Bibi Netanyahu, who is playing the Good Samaritan, taking care of these wounded Al-Qaeda fighters out of the goodness of his heart.
Yeah. Isn't that great, huh?
Yeah. I mean, that does kind of go with the propaganda line we're fed about how noble Israel is and how they're so civilized and these people are fighting are all savages. But then, of course, you look at the way that they, you know, were documented in shooting down 600 some innocent Palestinian children in a certain, you know, fairly narrow time frame back, 10, 15 years ago. A British medical journal documented this, that their soldiers routinely shoot to kill snipers, shooting to kill little kids playing on sidewalks and schoolyards and things like that. I mean, if they're helping Al-Qaeda fighters out of the goodness of their hearts, there's some kind of a strange paradox going on.
It's like a bad B movie, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's the kind of movie that you'd, even though you paid good money, you might seriously consider walking out of. It's so bad, and yet this is like the reality we're facing. These people, I actually really enjoy at this point whenever any of these puppets, these prostitutes in politics, get up and speak. Someone told me a line or two that Obama spoke in his State of the Union address. I can't remember it, to be honest, but it was just epic, you know, classic hypocrisy, you know, uber hypocrisy. These people are revealing just how fake, how dishonorable, immoral they are every time they get up and speak, because nothing they say bears any resemblance whatsoever to the truth. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty interesting to see Netanyahu get up, the same man who, if you recall, in Operation Cast Lead 2008-2009, when you had the previous government in place, Netanyahu eventually ran on a platform of a promise, a pledge to the Israeli people that he would, if there was another altercation with the people of Gaza, that he would, quote, finish the job. This was the language that he used. And if you understand Israeli culture,
Sounds a lot like that line, Hitler should have finished the job, used by the very extreme anti-Jewish Nazi fringe. And do you think he was consciously borrowing from that and suggesting that maybe they were going to try to, you know, just do a final solution on the Palestinians?
The relationship and likeness of Israeli policy with it, at least the accusations made against the Nazis. There's so many lies about World War II and Nazi Germany and Hitler and whatnot. Not that there weren't crimes committed and all sorts of things, but when you look at what the Nazis were accused of, if we're to believe what they're accused of, the likeness between the Nazis and the current power structure within Israel could hardly be any more alike. You know, they bear so many resemblances. You could make a strong argument that the Israeli version of Nazism is worse. In fact, when you look at the empirical evidence of how things actually transpired in World War II, the argument becomes quite clear. The treatment of people within the concentration camps of Germany, by empirical evidence and really affirmed by things like Ursula Haverbeck, who people, if they don't know about her, Google her or go onto YouTube and look up Ursula Haverbeck. And this amazing old lady in Germany who spoke some tremendous wisdom and is sitting in prison right now, if I'm not mistaken, for saying these things. The treatment of the people within the concentration camps of Germany under Nazi rule was far better than what you will find as the average experience for Palestinians currently in Israeli prisons and the concentration camp of Gaza, which literally is a concentration camp. It's wrong to call it a prison camp because prison denotes that you've committed a crime. The crime of those within the Gaza concentration camp is very similar to that which is accused of the Nazis. In the case of the Nazis, if you're a Jew, you go to the concentration camp. In the case of the Palestinians, you need only be Palestinian and you're put into a concentration camp. And this is the way they're living. So there are many parallels between what the Nazis are accused of doing and what the Israelis are actually doing.
Well, you're alluding to World War II revisionism, which I'm a supporter of overall. You know, I think that the mythic victor's history that we've been given about World War II is obviously a load of bullocks, as you Brits would, your Brit neighbors would put it, that, you know, obviously there were real Holocausts, including what happened at Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, Hamburg, and these other cities that the Allies made, you know, had going up in flames, in some cases radioactive flames, and Holocaust being a burnt sacrificial offering, it fits those images a lot better than what happened in the camps. But getting directly to that issue of what happened in those concentration camps, and you know, this is such a hot button issue. If you say the wrong thing about this, you're liable to being prosecuted and jailed in many European countries. Fortunately, that's not happening here in the U.S. Although if your name is Ernst Zundel, you'll get apparently shipped off somewhere else to get jailed. But in any case, the question would be, for me, you know, I'm still, you know, I'm not a 100% dyed-in-the-wool Holocaust revisionist by any means. There are a lot of issues that, to me, haven't really been resolved. And one of them is the issue of, well, were there a lot, you know, were there mass killings of people going on in these camps at all? And there are some Holocaust revisionists who say, no, there weren't. These camps were all very nice, and they had soccer teams and swimming pools. And then it was only at the end of the war when the Allies had bombed Germany into smithereens and there was no more life support left in the whole country that the camps turned into hellholes and everybody starved and died of typhus. So that's the extreme version.
Yeah.
And I'm questioning that because for a number of reasons, but one of them is that we know these were labor camps. I'll grant you that. They were primarily slave labor camps. Now, the question is, what about the people who couldn't work, whether they were children, old people, people who were weak, sick, disabled? The Nazis had a pretty ruthless policy towards weeding out undesirable genetic specimens. I think it's fairly well documented that a lot of that went on. And so when people argue that a lot of these work camps, the people who couldn't work were essentially killed one way or another. I don't know if it was gas chambers. Questions have been raised about that. But a lot of mass killings anyway of the useless eaters. I'm not convinced that didn't happen. How about you?
Yeah, no, I don't doubt for a second that there were many crimes committed. I think it's what the problem is that the way the argument is presented is a choice between one of two extremes. When the truth is in the middle, it's not one of those two extremes. There's no question that in war, all sorts of atrocities will be committed on all sides. And anyone who doubts that is really delusional, quite frankly. Many Americans think that Americans don't commit horrendous crimes because we have a higher moral values and whatnot. Now, a lot of that's been dissipated or destroyed for some with things like Abu Ghraib and, you know, Guantanamo and other examples, you know, pissing on Qurans and all sorts of stuff. But the truth of the matter is that in war, it is pure insanity, pure insanity. And when you're in a war, you will commit crimes. People commit crimes. There will be rape. There will be extrajudicial killings, executions. There will be torture. All of this will happen. So the idea that the Germans would be so virtuous that they would not have done any of this, if you want to try and take it to that extreme, is ridiculous, if you ask me.
Wait, though, Ken. In the Japanese POW camps in the U.S., or rather the Japanese internment camps of Japanese civilians, I should say, I don't think there's any documentation whatsoever of labor camps happening where anybody who can't work is just summarily executed. So there would be a difference there.
Yes, and that's a point well taken, for sure. And the accusations against the Germans for eugenics and taking out those that were weakening, you know, the nation and so on and so forth, I agree. That's very well established. And I don't doubt for a second that many crimes were committed along that kind of philosophical line. You know, there is a lot of empirical evidence for that. The, you know, the things that we can openly dispute and show that are absolutely untrue are obvious things like the 6 million figure. I mean, this figure is nonsensical. No one actually who's serious even espouses that figure any longer. Historically, it's been disproven and acknowledged even by those who've parroted the conventional line about World War II. Nobody who's serious will suggest that 6 million Jews were killed. And nobody who's serious will defend the idea that there was an active extermination campaign to get rid of all Jews, no matter what the number was. This is not a seriously debatable thing. It's only a debate amongst those who are still deeply within the programming of conventional history. So I will agree the United States treated the internment camps of the Japanese in a better way, for sure. Still unjust, of course. You know, you detain people simply because of their ethnicity. Nobody in the modern world certainly would espouse that, but that's what we did. But the treatment was probably considerably better. You have to give it that. Of course, the situation was totally different as well. In Germany, you had the Allies, the good guys, us, bombing the crap out of all of Germany. And the supply lines were being cut to such a degree that it wasn't just people in the concentration camps that were starving to death and dying of disease. People in the normal civilian population were also dying from starvation. And so the situation was drastically different. If the context had been the same in America, do you reckon the behavior and treatment of the Japanese would have been the same? I don't think so. I think if Americans were starving to death and supply lines were being cut, and the situation was becoming so harsh that our enemy, who we held captive, was you know, partly connected or linked to this, I don't think the treatment would have been nearly as good. So, you know, we got to look at the context as well.
Well, that's a really good point. You know, I've made that point when people talk about Assad in Syria being such a horrendous war criminal and who massively mistreats his civilians and minorities, and then people who also accuse various other kinds of governments of mistreating minorities and shutting down independence movements. But if you look at the way the U.S. has treated people who were essentially trying to secede or not recognize federal authority, such as, let's say, the Branch Davidians at Waco, you know, it actually makes people like Assad look like Mother Teresa.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, let's be realistic about what Syria and Bashar al-Assad have been facing. I mean, you know, this is a massive influx of foreign mercenaries funded by the most disgustingly hypocritical, immoral entities on the planet, especially when we really get down and dirty with the reality of Israel and certainly with Saudi Arabia. This monstrosity, this nation is the most offensive nation on the planet, almost indisputably. I mean, you know, there are no rights for women at all. And, you know, people are being executed in mass, as we see recently, even with a Muslim sheikh who had the audacity to speak out against this grotesque regime, being executed, beheaded. This is the funding and the basis of what's happening in Syria. How are you supposed to deal with that? I mean, how is it possible to deal with that kind of reality and not end up with many of your own people killed as well? How is it possible that you would expect someone as a leader of a nation not to be killing some of their own people, even if it were intentionally? The situation is so dire. So, you know, even if he's killing Syrians, if those Syrians are even reasonably thought to be collaborating with this incredibly destructive, psychopathic, violent force that's collaborating with nefarious and destructive forces on the outside, I mean, you know, there's just nothing that this man could have done that would have satisfied those manipulated by the propaganda machine that exists. So I'm not making excuses for him. My personal belief is that there's hardly any doubt that he must have made mistakes. He does not strike me as a stupid man. Even Saddam Hussein, he made mistakes, but Saddam Hussein didn't strike me as a stupid man.
Well, he made some boneheaded moves. He did. Like listening to April Glaspie saying that the United States would let him take Kuwait.
He did. He got suckered right into that for sure. But, you know, the way, you know, he did disarm, you know, he did do what he needed to do in order to
That wasn't very smart either.
No, I have to say.
And his attack on Iran that launched that imposed war was pretty stupid too.
And Syria, you know, getting rid of their chemical weapons as well. But I mean, what was the choice? To not disarm? I mean, they were just lying and saying he hadn't disarmed anyway. So if he hadn't disarmed, they would have done exactly what they did. And you know, he did the only thing he could have done, quite frankly, to try and stave off what was coming.
And, well, if he found a way to not disarm, he actually might have been able to stave it off. We know that with Gaddafi in Libya, probably they wouldn't have been able to overthrow and murder him if he hadn't cooperated with the non-proliferation efforts and turned over his so-called turnkey nuclear program to the authorities. So the moral of all of this, if you're the leader of a country that is trying to keep some independence, autonomy, and sovereignty, is make sure you get something that will dissuade them from overthrowing you. Do not cooperate with them. Do not cooperate with non-proliferation any more than you really have to. You know, be reasonable, but not, don't just roll over for them, because they'll reward you by killing you.
Well, I get your point, and it's well taken, but in hindsight, it's a lot easier to say that. I mean, you know, if Saddam Hussein had chosen to flout all of the demands upon him and provably maintain or increase his weapons of mass destruction capability, I don't seriously think he would have had the technological ability to really stave off any serious attack unless he had a nuclear weapon. If he had a nuclear weapon and it was provably the case, as in the case of North Korea, we can see, yes, we do cause problems for North Korea. We do villainize them. But at the end of the day, you know, so far at least, we have not actually picked a fight with them. They can fight back, and this is understood. So, you know, if he could have gotten a nuclear weapon, and this is actually, you know, this is an interesting subject we're talking about here. The lesson really to Iran should be, I mean, in this case, what you're saying, actually, the logic there is that Iran is being stupid, because I actually believe wholeheartedly that Iran is not pursuing nuclear weapons. I don't see any evidence for it.
I agree.
I see historically a nation that has continuously resisted war, and even with serious provocations and taking of their national lands and whatnot, they have not indulged, except for in the one case where they had no choice, which was the Iran-Iraq war, which we all know was imposed on them by us. Iran is pursuing, in my opinion, a policy of not seeking weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons. And, you know, by your logic, you know, this is a stupid decision.
Well, no, because I think the Iranian leadership has, number one, well, they do believe morally and ethically that
they have
that these nuclear weapons are haram because they kill large numbers of civilians. And I think they're probably right. According to Islam, that's correct. But secondly, I think they make what may be a correct calculation that they can defend their country reasonably well, actually perhaps better without nuclear weapons. They have a big country. They have a population of which perhaps one third of the people are very more than willing to die to defend their country. And, you know, we saw that in the imposed war. That's a pretty tough nut to crack. And all of the U.S. war games that were run, such as the Atlantic Magazine, which commissioned a big set of simulations back, more than 10 years ago, on what would happen if the U.S. tried to go after Iran, Iran always wins. They don't need nuclear weapons. They win conventionally. They shut down shipping in the Gulf with their Sunburn missiles. They rain death upon U.S. forces, the Green Zone in Baghdad and everywhere else in the region. They can rain death on Tel Aviv anytime they want to. They don't need nuclear weapons to do that. So I think they're making the right move, both ethically and strategically.
Well, you make a very strong point, and as always, I absolutely love your insights. Yes, they do have a very formidable defensive military capability, and that it is truly a defensive capability. Obviously, they have medium-range missiles which can reach Israel, but that's a strategic imperative. Of course, you can't say that's offensive. They need this. They must have this. To not have it would be, you know, along the lines of where you make the argument that it's stupid. You have no defense. I still think, however, that, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. I think Saddam Hussein and Qaddafi, he had more choices, I'd say, but Saddam Hussein was caught in a place where to flout it and literally maintain and provably show that you're increasing your desire to accumulate weapons of mass destruction, I think he would have only been done that much sooner. He probably staved off, and we can get into a whole other subject about you know, Saddam Hussein and what actually happened to him. But the bottom line is, I will agree with you. We've taught the lesson of the world that it is imperative that you have something to protect yourself, because clearly if you do disarm, that is no protection. In fact, the precedent has been set more than once. You will be destroyed. Your entire nation will be destroyed. And in fact, what benefit did Syria gain by getting? They got rid of their chemical weapons ahead of schedule. You know, why didn't that buy any favor? I mean, it bought them no favor at all. You know, and this is where actually we get into another interesting subject about Russia's role in all of this. It was Russia that handed, you know, the United States a life preserver in the aftermath of their failed false flag, you know, Ghouta chemical weapons attack and all the crap that led up to that, a la Iraq. You know, it was like Iraq 2.0. It was Russia that handed America a life preserver and brokered that deal. And has that really helped out Syria? I mean, it doesn't appear to be so. And it's a horrible thing, isn't it? I mean, if we look at this seriously, the lesson to all of the nations of the world is get the most powerful destructive weapons you can, because that's the only way you can defend yourself against this monstrosity that we're sitting here paying taxes to.
Absolutely. And that underlines the point you made earlier, that it's the people who create war who are ultimately the most responsible for all of the horrors. And, you know, for example, if you agree that World Wars 1 and 2 were really the same war, and that it was basically a preemptive war by the British to stop the rise of Germany before Germany passed them, which I think is the bottom line of what World War 1/2 is really all about, then the prime villain and the group responsible for the carnage, not only in the cities that they bombed, but also in the German concentration camps and everywhere else, would be the British, and then, of course, the banksters behind them. So the person who starts the war, the aggressor, is really the prime guilty party. All of those horrors of war come out of the fact of war, which was launched by an aggressor. And whatever you want to say about Victor's justice at Nuremberg, where they tortured people into false confessions, that principle principle, the Nuremberg principle, that aggression is the supreme war crime, is a monumental human achievement. And I only wish that more countries today would respect it.
Yeah, I have exactly the same view. I mean, you know, for those who delve into Nuremberg and whatnot, it's just an obscenity. It had nothing to do with true due process of law at all. It was just a kangaroo court on steroids and so on and so forth. But I agree with you wholeheartedly. The conclusion that the supreme crime is wars of aggression, everything that comes, once you start a war, as I said earlier, I don't care, you know, how noble you think your nation is, Americans suffer from this badly, and they really should be recovering from this ignorance in the aftermath of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and Bagram and all of the things that we've done in these places. You know, the fact is, when you enter into a war, you know, you pointed out that the internment camps in America, but, you know, let's look at the things that we did in the lands that we were actually fighting the wars. We did all of it, you know, the whole thing, raping children, you know, raping children in front of their parents.
Yeah, yeah. I was just horrified to see what happened in, you know, I didn't realize that the Western Front, as the Allies were advancing on Germany, was that bad. But yeah, it turns out the American forces were raping everything in sight, pretty much the same way the Russian forces were coming from the other direction. And that's not what they taught us in school.
No, war is nasty. War is ugly. And, you know, one of the recent examples of where you actually had a noble war, isn't it all too ironic, is Iran, which fought a noble war. And this is one thing I had no idea of until I visited Iran. I think it was on my second or maybe my third trip there. But I visited the Peace Museum in Tehran. And, you know, I can hear, you know, the program people saying, oh, yeah, the peace, you know, this country's been peaceful for so many centuries. You know, yes, they actually have a peace museum in Tehran, and it's actually legitimate. And one of the things that you'll learn if you go to that museum and actually look at true history is that Iran was hit by Saddam Hussein, this bastard, you know, vicious bastard, our attack dog at the time. Armed with chemical weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. And he was hitting places. Not only the Kurds got hit with chemical weapons, Iranians. There are 100,000 Iranians to this day suffering from the effects of chemical weapons exposure a la Saddam Hussein, our attack dog.
And the Western media never talks about it.
Never, ever talks about it at all. I've met people who are suffering from the chemical weapons exposure that Saddam Hussein is responsible for, that we're responsible for, quite frankly. And you know what? This Iran, this nation of Iran that we villainize so much, and I'm sure you know this, they were really debated the question. It's kind of like back in the late 1800s when there was this question of America being an empire or you know, not being an empire and staying within its borders and whatnot. There was a healthy debate about that at some point, and sadly it was lost. Iran had a debate about how do we respond to Iraq doing this, you know, hitting us with chemical weapons and, you know, really going after civilians on a massive level and whatnot. Do we hit Baghdad? Do we hit Basra? And they decided no. And the reason why is because they did not consider that to be in line with their understanding of Islam, of what it is to be a Muslim. And, you know, no one knows this. Almost nobody knows this in the West. But that is the way that Iran carried itself. That's a noble war where you're being attacked by an aggressor who's being supported by the whole world. Literally, the whole world was supporting Saddam Hussein almost without exception. And you're being attacked on this most criminal level, and you don't resort to the same level of depravity and immorality that your enemy does. That's a moral war, and it's the only war that should ever be fought. If you need to defend yourself from a foreign invader, then you do so. And you kill every last son of a bitch who's coming into your country. You don't allow that for a second. So while I believe in peace, I also believe in fighting for what's right. You don't let people come in and steal your land and violate your women and kill your families. You know, you don't do that. Iran gave us a perfect example of what it is to be involved in a noble war. I don't even remember what was the last war that we've been involved in that was noble. I guess the War of Independence probably is the only one.
Some people would say the War of 1812 was the last arguably defensive war. That was the war when the British burned down Washington, D.C. And of course, some folks say that anybody who did that today would be doing us a favor. But so as far as this issue of Islam being the ethical code that led the Iranians to refuse to retaliate against Iraqi civilians and to refuse to use chemical weapons, even though it would have been in their strategic interest to do so, this raises this larger issue of how in the West we're being bombarded with this notion that radical Islam is the problem, that all of this violence is being caused because there are these radical Islamic religious fanatics out there who just can't wait to attack us because they hate our freedoms. And you look a little closer at the whole situation and suddenly you say, wait a minute, it's actually Islam is providing a sort of a moderating influence that is preventing people from being as violent as they might otherwise be. And in all of these cases where we're told that radical Muslim extremists, you know, attacked Western civilians, you look a little closer and then you say, wait a minute, what kind of radical Islamic extremists are these? Muhammad Atta, Hebrew-speaking, stripper-dating, cocaine-snorting, whiskey-drinking, prostitute-fancying, gambling junket-loving.
Isn't that great, man? Yeah, I love that. I love that narrative.
9/11 hijackers leave an alcohol-soaked Quran on the bar the night before they martyr themselves, you know, and on and on and on. You look at virtually all of these big, supposedly fanatical extremist attacks in the West, you know, time after time after time. The people that are blamed for them, who are probably patsies, are not the least bit religious. They're not Muslim extremists at all. They're the opposite. They're people maybe from Muslim backgrounds, or in some cases Mossad agents impersonating people from Muslim backgrounds, who are the most extremely un-Islamic people in the world in terms of their behavior. So how does the Western public still think that any of this has anything to do with Islam?
It's an amazingly well-orchestrated, heavily funded, backed campaign to create a clash of civilizations based on a false premise, because you know as well as I do that the average Muslim is the same as the average Christian, as the average person, whatever faith, around the world. And basically all of us want the same thing. You know, we want to be able to live a dignified life. We generally, if we're reasonably healthy, we care about our family, we care about our community, and we want to be free. You know, we don't want someone, stepping on our neck because we exercise our right as human beings to be free. This is normal. It's the same throughout. I don't care. It's not like Islam has a monopoly on virtue. There are plenty of virtuous people across the spectrum, but you have to say, you know, especially when I look to, I have to say, you know, I have developed a real, real love and appreciation and respect for Iran and the way that it's carried itself. It has its problems. Don't get me wrong. I'm the first one to acknowledge there is abuse of power and corruption in Iran. Of course there is. And it's significant and it needs to be, you know, sorted out. But that's for the Iranian people to sort out. We have a lot of nerve. When our house is a filthy mess of corruption, nothing within our society is healthy. Everything about the way we're living our lives and the leaders that we allow to continue to represent us is so offensive and grotesque that we have one hell of a nerve to even think to point the finger to someone else and actually say, you need to sort your stuff out. Our house needs to be cleaned. And we are not cleaning our house, at least. Well, we are. There are many people working for that goal. But our house is a mess. So what I see is an amazingly obvious and transparent agenda to create a clash of civilizations, which really doesn't exist. Because the people of Islam, the average person of Islam, is more than offended. They are disturbed deeply by what is happening with so-called ISIS. And they ultimately are the biggest victims of this fake Islam, you know, and they really have nothing to do with it. The major funder of this, as we all know, is Saudi Arabia. You know, I mean, you know, and the Gulf states, which are all puppet states, they're all our allies. You know, this is not true Islam. This is a grotesque perversion of Islam, just like Christianity has been perverted. I mean, how can people like George Bush or any of these so-called Christians in the U.S. government talk about being Christians? How dare you call yourself a Christian? And the question that I pose to people on a regular basis, if you believe you're a Christian, my question to you is, what country would Jesus bomb? Because I want you to give me a logical argument as to what country Jesus would bomb, and I also want you to pretend as if you're Jesus, and as Jesus, explain to me how you would be justified in bombing another country and killing innocent people. It's beggar's belief that people even think to call themselves Christians when they clearly have no idea whatsoever what Jesus Christ himself stood for, or at least what we're told he stood for. You know, it's a transparent attempt to get us to fight each other, because the imperative of tyranny, if a tiny minority wants to rule the world, is to divide the people. You cannot allow the people to do what they will naturally do, which is to cooperate with each other. So you must divide them on every level. So bomb mosques and give money to psychopaths and fuel them with drugs and weapons and send them into countries and just set it alight. This is what you need. It's good for them. That's the policy. And everything we see playing out in the Middle East is not an accident. It's intentional. It's not a failure. It's actually the policy. If you believe what you're being told, well, that's your first problem. Why would you believe anything any of these so-called leaders say? It's beyond ridiculous. There is no integrity there. So all of the stuff that we're seeing is part of our policy. We need to change the policy, don't we? We need to clean our house.
Hear, hear. As Pogo put it, we've met the enemy, and he is us. Well, all right, Ken O'Keefe, I appreciate it. I have to run right now, heading for Press TV, a place where you often pop up as well. So until the next time, have a good one, and thank you so much. Keep up the great work, brother, and God bless you.
God bless you, my brother. Thank you.
Finally come to the edge of Aquarius. I never lived through the mind apocalypse. There'll be pine, the sky above, lemonade springs, a goddamn American utopian dream. Believe that in you more out the mystical plane.
Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing you all kinds of interesting news outside the corporate mainstream, and bringing on another guest here. That would be my perennial regular favorite guest, Rolf Lindgren, a compadre from way back here in Wisconsin. And he's got some news about the Stephen Avery case.
Who has once met Steve Avery in person.
Yeah. So Steve Avery is this guy who was apparently falsely convicted of rape or something, spent 18 years in prison, and it turned out he was innocent. DNA cleared him, and he filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the police, and suddenly, boom, he's busted again and back in jail. So tell me about that, Rolf. This guy apparently was really badly railroaded by a miscarriage of justice, and maybe two of them.
Twice, in my opinion. This is the fabled Netflix movie Making a Murderer, which is one of the hottest movie in the world right now. Everybody's watching it, and it's just on Netflix. It's going to expand to other media sources as soon as Netflix is done milking it for all they can. Steve Avery was convicted in 1985 of a violent rape where he left. Well, he didn't do it, but somebody did. And someone named Gregory Allen actually did this rape. They figured out who did it. And this guy, he left her for dead, but then they nailed Steve Avery for it, even though he had 15 alibi witnesses, 16 alibi witnesses, and he was 50 miles away. But they still convicted him anyway, and then that was in 1985. This Gregory Allen then went on to go and rape more people. Since they didn't get the real guy, the right guy, the real rapist was still on the loose. So he went and raped some more people and finally got caught about 10 years later. Meanwhile, Steve Avery, in the meantime, the new DNA testing came along. Mm-hmm. And eventually they proved that he was innocent, and they showed that Gregory Allen was the guy that did it. Now, of course, they knew many years earlier that Gregory Allen did it, but they let him sit, you know, dangle in prison for anywhere from 2 to 10 years longer than they should have. Actually, they knew from the beginning that he didn't do it.
Really? Okay. So was this one of those cases where there was some kind of political reason for getting him? Or was it just a case where they had to get a conviction and he was the easiest guy to convict?
There was somebody in the police department that didn't like Steve Avery, so they just when the victim came to, they just showed a bunch of pictures, and you know they somehow made it that Steve Avery got picked. Basically, what they did is they took six photos. Three of the people were much older than Avery, and two of the people were much heavier than Avery, and then they asked the victim who looks the closest. Mm-hmm. Of course, they picked Avery. Okay. Wow. They also picked people who had prior record, so they had their mug shots. Now, Avery did have a prior conviction for a burglary when he was like a 19-year-old, him and his friend, like, you know, somebody broke into a liquor store or something when they were drunk, you know, one of that kind of stuff. But anyways, then what they do is here's how they manipulated the witness. Then they came back to her and said, we've been investigating the case, and that man that you picked, we found out he has a criminal record. Huh. Okay, well.
So they were basically able to con the victim into going after him.
And then they come back a few days later, you know, that man you picked, we've been investigating, he's just been arrested. So they start to think, oh, he must have done it. He had a criminal record. He must have done it. The police arrested him. You know, so by the time they have a trial, the person is absolutely certain that he did it. And then the detectives found out within days that he wasn't even there. He was somewhere else in Wisconsin, uh-huh. with 22 people, 16 who testified at trial. He had an alibi. They also had credit card receipts where they were shopping, and still the jury found him guilty because the jury decided that the victim's testimony was accurate. And all the alibi witnesses must have been lying. So all these alibi witnesses were liars.
Wow!
Apparently,
unbelievable.
It was a giant conspiracy. Apparently.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of conspiracies, Rolf, this actually does illustrate a situation that I've argued is probably really common, which is that you know we're all brought up with the myth that justice prevails, and you know bad guys always get the just desserts, and all of this sort of thing. And these mm-hmm. are like sort of you know Santa Claus stories that we tell our kids, but in the real world, I don't think there's really that much evidence for this. In fact, most crimes go unsolved. The percentage of correctly solved crimes must be quite low. Probably a very high percentage, a shockingly high percentage of people who've actually been convicted of things and so on are innocent. The machinery of justice is really more about propping up this myth that the bad guy always gets caught than it is about actually getting justice. And that's why you can frame people for stuff like 9/11.
I agree with that. I think when they bust people for murder, I think probably 15 to 20% of the people are probably innocent. Mm. But there are certain cases where there's some murder cases where they know who did it. Okay, they really know.
Yeah.
But maybe half of them. But then the other half, they don't really know, and then they end up. And who knows how much? And anyways, just to follow up with Steve Avery though. He finally was released in 2003 after 18 years. In 2004, I noticed he was living in a shack and was only given $25,000 and hadn't even gotten that yet for his time served. So
that's not a lot of money for 18 years in prison.
Yeah, $25,000. I sent $500 into the Avery Foundation. And then in 2005, there was something called the Avery Crime Bill, which was in September 7th, 2005, I testified at the state capitol on behalf of Steve Avery. I was the only normal citizen at the hearing. Every single other witness was either a police chief, a sheriff, some law school professor, or some witness from Avery's case.
So well, you know, Rolf, you may be the first citizen of Wisconsin. I mean, in terms of activist citizens, you're definitely up there at the top shelf.
And I met Steve Avery. I talked to him personally. We walked like into the hallway or away from everyone. I talked to him, not for that long, maybe 5 minutes, maybe even 10. I gave him my business card. I reminded them that, I tried to support you last year. And then I gave him my card and I said, if you ever need any help, you can give me a call. And this was in September 7th. Well, this woman turned up missing, named Teresa Halbach, disappeared on October 31st. So we're talking less than 2 months later, he was already a murder suspect for right. another murder. And now this program has been made over the last 10, just after I testified and Avery was there too, who also spoke. This happened, and then the film people read about it in the New York Times, and they came from New York. They were like journalism and legal, and one of them was a law student, and they came to Wisconsin and started filming in 2005, and they filmed all the way through since then.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie, I don't know why it was just decided to be released now, but there's some good news. For obviously the best disinfectant is sunlight. So right now, Steve Avery, I think, has a great shot of getting a 14th Amendment due process appeal,
mm-hmm.
and also possibly getting new evidence. Apparently they've gotten all kinds of new evidence just coming in, like jurors are calling in. And I don't think Steve Avery has been in federal court yet. See, one of the problems that you can have is that once your cases are denied, then if you can't just refile the same thing. You have to have a new legal argument, okay? But I don't think that his case has actually been to federal court yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where usually in these cases, you end up winning in federal court. You might not be aware that about 60% of all death penalty sentences get overturned, most of them in federal court, under 14th Amendment claims.
Now, wait a minute. Is he sentenced to death?
No, he's not sentenced to death.
We don't have death.
Yeah. What I'm saying is that most people who win their appeal, they win it in federal court after state court appeals have been exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the most common things are either new evidence or ineffective assistance.
Okay, well, we're just about at the end of our slot this time, but we may do another show on him. And then, like, a couple of quick things. First, this Netflix movie, is it taking the interpretation that he's innocent?
I would say that it's actually very neutral,
mm-hmm. okay.
but the overall, it's sort of like, but the evidence,
fair and balanced.
Most people think he's innocent who watch the movie.
Okay, great.
And I just sent Steve Avery some books in the mail and a letter. I'm hoping to either visit him or talk to him on the phone soon.
Okay, so if you do talk to him, tell him that we'd love to find a way to get him on Truth Jihad Radio, and maybe we can get you back to talk more about this case and the appalling injustices that are built into our system. It is.
This is an outrage. Justice for Avery.
Okay, thank you, Rolf Lindgren.
Avery.
Sounds good. All right. Well, take care, Rolf. Look forward to talking to you after you meet with Steve Avery. Take care.
All right, we'll be in touch. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
There'll be pine sky above lemonade springs. I've got them American utopian dreams. Outside in the heart of America, no love in a time of hysteria. It's here for the hills, every man for himself. Nobody helping out nobody else. Ain't the way that the Maurice said it'd be in the 21st century. Forgiveness, vote for change.